IFPRI Policy Seminar, A Post-Bali Food Security Agenda, held on May 6, 2014 in Washington, D.C. Speaker Eugenio Diaz Bonilla from IFPRI.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you to all of you for being here. This is the title of another paper. It's a combination with David. We are working on Bali in general, but then specific on food stocks. And that would be the title once it's published. Now it's sort of a very summarized version of the paper, a little bit on background, legal issues, economic issues, and then conclusions. As you know, food security has been a main problem or issue in all the negotiations during the Uruguay round, after the Uruguay round with Doha. In 2008, it collapsed because of food security reasons related to, at that time, a market access issue, which was the special safer mechanism. And then it almost collapsed in Bali because of the food stocks, also related to food security concerns. So food security is not new in the negotiations. Which is new is the background of the conditions at the world level. And Stefan touched on that. I'm going to just mention the last one, changes in consumption and in marketing channels, which it has implications for this view of only public distribution system based in a couple of staple products. When you see it in a lot of countries that it's been diversified, the diets and also the channels, there is a nice work by IFPRI with the Asian Development Bank showing the changes in rice and potato in four Asian countries. And that's happening in a lot of countries, the modernization of the marketing channels of food products. And then the final point as an introduction, the Bali Agreement is just a small portion of the Doha Development Round. And what I'm going to talk is just one ministerial decision among the ones that are related to agriculture and cotton that David mentioned. So the legal issues, as you know, the basic point is if you are in the green box, you have to comply with the fundamental requirements and also with the basic criteria. Among the basic criteria, the one that was the point of the discussion is the fact that you cannot give price support. If you go to the Annex 2, Paragraph 3 that covers food stocks and Annex 2, Paragraph 4 that covers domestic food aid, you can subsidize consumers. You can, you know, do whatever you want. Footnote 5 and 6 tells you that you can subsidize poor people. The problem is how you purchase that foods that are used to subsidize. And then if you purchase at market prices, no problem. If you purchase at what's called administered prices, then you have to compare to the fixed external reference price of 86, 88, which, you know, prices at the time were lower. And if you have in domestic currency, probably are completely out of date compared to what that country may be paying right now. So that's the issue. And if you have that price gap, you have to multiply by the quantity of the production that is eligible for support, and then you may get in trouble by violating the 10 de minimis if you don't have any other aggregate measure of support that you can count against. So then comes the proposal of the G33, as the name indicates. It has like 46 countries, but you know that all the G something, they never have the same number of countries that the number suggests. The G20, I call the G20 the G20 something, because you never know who may show up at the meetings. So this G33 have this proposal, basically do not count under the AMS, the aggregate measure of support, if you are buying for food security stocks and you buy for low income or resource poor producer, which is a category that is accepted under the Agreement on Agriculture. It's in Article 6.2. But there were two concerns. One, that by the way, that is the exact language that was in the 2008 modalities that David was referring to, revision 4. So the G33 took the language from what there was that like document before it collapsed everything in 2008. But there were two concerns. One is that you are violating the chapeau of the green box. You know, if you accept to give price support under the green box, that anything can go. So that's the first point. The second point is that several countries were concerned about the possibility of subsidized export from these food security stocks. And in fact, if you look at some research by IFPRI on Bangladesh, the prices of rice in Bangladesh track the price of subsidized rice in India. So they are integrated. So those two concerns, you didn't have time to get to a solution. So what negotiators do is what a time-honored tradition, you just kick down the road the can and say, you know, we'll postpone this discussion until later. But in the meantime, you have a peace clause. What does it mean? That developing countries that have an existing program will not be challenged under the Agreement on Agriculture, and then I'll explain what this may be relevant, if they comply with the rest of the Annex 2.3 and they comply with a series of conditions. They have to say, you know, we're going to violate the limits of domestic support by this much. We have to give information. You have to present all the information about the food security stocks in a template. So there's a lot of transparency and notification requirements if you want to be covered by the peace clause. So this was the same document before and after Bali. The key, that didn't change. The negotiations were based on for how long this clause was applicable. And there was this idea of temporary, which meant initially that it was until the next ministerial, which is usually 2 years. But then after that, it lapsed the peace clause. So basically, India was not happy with that solution, and they insisted on an interim solution, which is a not temporary solution. It's an interim solution which is standing until a permanent solution is found. So that changed the balance of the negotiation, and it was accepted. So in terms of the peace clause, as I said, basically all the WTO members need to get to a permanent solution, but now it's up to two ministerials, 4 years down the road. It covers only existing food security programs. It has a strong notification requirements, considering that a lot of countries now are behind schedule. So if you want to claim protection, then you need to be current on your notifications. There is a problem there in the language, as a lot of things that are, you know, put together in a hurry. The text says traditional staple food crops, which means that perhaps then livestock is not covered. But then the footnote on crops says that it refers to primary agricultural products that are predominant staples in traditional diet. So we will see, you know, if there is a challenge on that. Of course, LDCs, least developed countries, which is a United Nations category, they are exempted from everything, basically, so they are not covered by this. And a lot of countries in Africa are LDCs. Bangladesh is LDC. And the FSS, the food security stocks, may be challenged under other texts, you know, may be challenged under subsidies and countervailing agreements and so on. It doesn't say the ministerial decision, but the ministerial decision says that it are covered only to the specific things that are under the Agreement on Agriculture. Okay, so that's what happened. Then permanent solutions. The country should go and try to get a permanent solution. The first thing to notice, and contrary to a lot of claims by NGOs and saying, you know, the India was not allowed to have a food stamp program like the US. No, you can subsidize poor people all, you know, the way you want. The question is how you buy the products that then you give on a subsidized basis to poor people. And then I'm moving forward on different solutions. First, you can buy at market prices. Brazil has a food program that buys at market prices, and it covers a lot of people. The US has a market food security, food stamp program that buys at market prices. From a poor country, it makes sense not to have to increase the cost of your subsidized operations by, on top of that, buying above market price and then selling way below, so that's going to be a fiscal cost even way before you have a trade case against you. The other possibility is to work on eligible production. Remember, a lot of people think that eligible production after the Korean beef case, it's all production. No, it's eligible production. If you define eligible production in a way that is only part of the final production, then you can reduce the amount of eligible quantity that you are using. Then the other thing may be to change the fixed reference price to dollars. I argue in the paper why that can be possible. Some people say, no. If you had your notification originally in domestic currency, you are done. You know, you cannot change it. I would argue that the document says taking into account, and the food case, the Korean beef food case, clarify that relation between in accordance of Annex 3 and taking into account. A lot of developed countries, according to some simulation by Montemayor, the paper that ICTSD is putting out, basically, if you take these two things, the eligible quantity and dollar prices, then they do not exceed the minimums. Other possibility, adjust by inflation. People may argue that 18.4 allows you to do that. So other people would say, no, 18.4 says that the WTO members in the Agricultural Committee can take into account inflation when you, countries that are presenting the notifications, are presenting notifications. That doesn't allow you can't present the notification. It's the wording specifically says that the WT members that are reviewing the notification can take inflation into account. In any case, the point is that some countries, when they presented some of the variables, they presented in constant prices of 1991, like Mexico did, or constant prices of 1992, like Argentina did. So you have these huge differences. Whatever you did in your notifications at the beginning, then dooms your trade negotiations forever. So it looks like we may need to work a little bit on that. And finally, the thing that I proposed while I was in Bali, which is work on the relationship with the administered and market prices. I'm not going to get into that. There are a lot of other, I think, not good ideas. So this would be the legal issues. But the main problem, in my view, is not legal issues that the developing countries may not have room under the WTO or with some of the changes that we discussed. The issue are the operational and economic aspects of food security stocks. The first point to notice is problem that people may think, food security, price volatility, food stocks. You need to mention that. We need, the only thing that affects food security is price volatility or price extremes. And the only way to deal with price volatility and price extremes is through food security stocks. No, food security is a multidimensional concept. There's very nice work at the IFPRI in the past continues working on that, on what are the things that affect, for instance, wasting and stunting in children, which is a clear indication of food problems. And there are a lot of, women empowerment, health and nutrition, sanitation, and so on. So you have a lot of policies that affect a lot of variables that affect food security. And if we go to this unidimensional approach, we are, I think, in trouble. So I would just close with two comments. One is, in these issues, you need to always remember the Tinbergen rule and what I call the Bhagwati rule. You need as many instruments as objectives, A, and B, if you focus your policy instrument, you have to focus specifically on the problem that you are interested in. If you are interested in the poor producers, you are interested in the poor consumers, you don't need to subsidize crops. That's a step removed from the problem that you want to address. So you need to have instruments that do that. And I would argue that you need that you have the options under the WTO. What you need, we need to work is more on the economic and operational issues related to that. Thank you.